This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, Wei Ting and I are reviewing the Mr. McMahon series on Netflix with 6 straight days of reviews. The Double Shot will be coming back on Friday, September the 27th. We will be doing a free review of episode 1, and then episodes 2 through 6 will be covered exclusively for Post Wrestling Cafe members. Plus, this month, MCU Later is back covering Agatha All Along, and Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson have you covered for New Japan's Destruction in Kobe. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Rewind the dynamite from the post wrestling site. AEW lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Wei Ting, where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
And hello, welcome to Rewind a Dynamite Grand Slam. I'm John Pollock, along with Wei Ting, where tonight the bases were loaded. Did AEW hit a home run? That will be our question posed for tonight's edition of the show. How are you, Wei?
Not bad, John. Yeah, doing okay. I would say a pretty good professional wrestling show. Whether or not it's a Grand Slam, I suppose we will determine later on.
We will definitely get into that. Lots to come on today's show. And this is coming the day of the Mr. McMahon series, a 6-parter that Netflix dropped onto the wrestling world. Wei, have you ventured into any of the episodes yet?
I have, yes.
Mm-hmm. How many have you seen?
I've seen the first one. I started the second one, and then I decided at that point to jump over to the last one instead. So I'd say about 1 and then 2 halves.
Okay, so you've watched half of 2 episodes and 1 full episode.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's the most waiting answer I could expect so far. My brain is a fog, having watched all 6 of these today. And it was just way too much Vince McMahon after 6 hours for me. This is not a series that I would recommend binging. Take your time and go through this. It was a lot to watch. I know we're going to be spending a lot of time over the next week going through episode by episode. I'm going to be doing a show with Brandon Thurston and David Bixenspan on Thursday with sort of our overall thoughts. But just from what you have seen, Wei, and I think a lot of the attention will be placed on episode 6. Tell me how you felt that they handled this, given the fact that they had no access to Vince McMahon after the allegations came out. And this was a documentary series that, I mean, it was outlined today by Bill Simmons and David Shoemaker that there were thoughts like, will this actually get released? This went through a lot of iterations and they did make it to the finish line, but a very different documentary than the one they set out with to create.
Sure, yeah. I could definitely see that struggle in the final product. Like what this original project was set out to be, and maybe even what it was up until, you know, the initial retirement took place, was very different. And I think you could tell that this was like, there was a lot of reworking of like the source, whatever they captured, in order to turn it into the current product that it is. So I definitely feel like while watching even like the bookends of the show, it felt like there was a bit of a struggle, just even in the editing room, for what it is. So I haven't gotten to the Grant stuff yet, so I can't really comment on that. But as like,
that's one of the half watches. Yes.
Yeah, apologies.
Yes.
So maybe you're better to speak on it than I am at this point.
I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on the series. I mean, it goes into so many different stories to varying degrees. Of the stories they covered, I don't know if there were any that I watched and was like, man, what a gross misrepresentation of what actually happened. Like, I thought they hit the key points I think in several of them, there were details left out, some of which were important, some less so. I think overall, the strengths of the documentary. I thought that, number one, of course, they had the access to so much of this footage. Like, I thought this was a really well-edited documentary in that regard. It sounds like, you know, from those that, and just listening to Bill Simmons' most recent podcast, it sounds like they were just floored by the work that Chris Smith put into this. Bill Simmons, who is, I mean, the guy that helped launch the 30 for 30 series, said this was like the best, I don't know what the exact wording was, but like best like documentary filmmaker he has worked with, or the best team he has worked with. Like, that's some pretty high praise that's coming for Chris Smith, who came into this a total non-follower of professional wrestling. And sometimes that can be good, and sometimes that can be bad. It seemed in this case, he came into it with a pretty open mind about this whole thing and just a natural curiosity, which are what the best reporters or producers, that's going to be a common trait that they have, a curiosity to learn about this world. So I was impressed with that. Vince McMahon is a subject that I think that's going to be most people's thought on this, is what you got out of Vince McMahon. And that kind of became the premise of the whole six episodes, is who is this guy? And I've always stated that, you know, when it comes, especially when wrestling books were much more kind of in vogue, especially in WWE, it was a Vince McMahon book. How great would that be? And I was the opposite. I was like, I think this guy would have a horrible book, because I think his memory is pretty terrible. You know, I think he had a good amount of recall of what he is put through here. But there's also a lot of stuff that comes across to Vince McMahon, that here is a guy that, I think at the end, I don't think there's a whole lot of sympathy towards Vince McMahon that is through 6 hours of hearing his stories, his approach to business. I found it very depressing, just a lot of the family stuff, that especially when you see the fact that he himself had such a desire to earn his own father's, Vince Sr.'s, respect and love, and the cycle goes through with Shane, where I thought this documentary was pretty revealing about Shane. Like, I thought he mentions one line in one of the episodes about, you know, when we're out there in front of the camera, we don't peel back everything, but we give people enough. And that sort of was Shane's demeanor in this. Like, he wasn't going to flat out state his relationship with his father or just be a total open book. But you could just, you could take a lot of his answers and you could see that, just that repeated itself with Vince and Shane's relationship, that I found to be, if you were Vince McMahon and watched this, there's a lot you can probably be taken aback by and look back. I don't know how much of these scandals he necessarily looks back at in terrible terms, but to just see your son speaking about just the way he was about trying to earn this man's respect and love. Like, I don't know how a father watches that and feels like they did the best job as a father, to be quite frank.
Well, if there's any sympathy that you might have for Vince, it would be hearing his childhood stories and what it meant for him to experience the approval of his dad at maybe the one point right before he passed, hearing "I love you" from his dad for the first time. I mean, that's probably some of the most vulnerable we've ever seen Vince McMahon on camera, and maybe some of the only time we've ever heard him even speak about that. So I think, I don't know if this is intentional or not, but just being presented with that footage, I think gives a lot of viewers potentially the narrative that somehow that might be responsible for the type of terrible person that he is today. The fact that he never received that sort of love from his parent. If there's any sympathy you might have, it might be related to that. The rest of what I've seen, again, I haven't seen the whole series yet, feels very much, it's like Vince acknowledging that these things have happened, kind of chalking a lot of it up to just like, you know, the right move for business and being unapologetic.
That's the constant. And that extends to like just family stuff too. Like, it's always business. Business is number one. And I think you see an individual that just feels very just detached from life almost, in terms of like that singular focus above all else. I guess you can, this certainly, if you had your concerns that this was going to be just a hagiography of Vince McMahon, that was not what this was. I thought they went into,
I don't even know what that means.
This was not like a hero worship piece of Vince McMahon. Oh. I think they went into a lot of the scandals, especially in like the Ring Boy scandal was focused upon in episode two. They went, they interviewed Phil Mushnick. I thought Dave Meltzer was tremendous throughout this series. Like, this to me, I think, is a much different documentary if you don't have a Dave Meltzer in there, that they used as kind of Dave Shoemaker's role was essentially the one that was, I mean, as he put it, he was the glue from topic to topic and someone that can fill in the blanks that you constant for documentary filmmaking. Dave Meltzer was the fact checker, and Dave Meltzer was the person that they leaned on as the authority of Vince McMahon's world, where you have all of these people that rotate around Vince McMahon and his orbit that are in, like, it's presenting without saying it, like this ultimate control that Vince McMahon had all over these people. And even in Extensa's documentary, like, there is a fascinating, they're talking about the scandals in episode two, and Jimmy Hart is just like right there. It's like, he's being asked about, you know, stuff he heard, and he's like, I don't know how much stuff I'm allowed to be talking about here and what they want out in the open. I mean, he's just pretty much, and then you never hear from Jimmy Hart again. It's like, okay, this guy has essentially no credibility for this. Like, he is there to say the company line.
He's there to present maybe the fear amongst, you know, the roster at the time.
I think it was a very informative, like there's a lot of Jimmy Harts probably. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not all these people are, like a Bret Hart, who is not going to have any of those reservations that are going to speak openly. But in terms of somebody that if there was someone that I think comes off the worst, I would think you, like, outside of like Vince McMahon, he said some terrible things. He had a awful like recollection or description of like Rita Chatterton, basically denying the rape charge in 1986, but then caveating it with, but even if it had been a rape, the statute of limitations has run out.
Awful.
I was like, awful. Oh my God, dude. Like, just like diarrhea of the mouth to just shut up. Mm-hmm. I thought, like, again, there's so much to digest here. I'm glad you and I are doing individual reviews of each episode, because a lot of this just is coming to me, mm-hmm, as I'm recalling it. The chapter on like the Benoit murder suicide and into the concussion discussion. Like, yep, you have legitimately, I think WWE can hang its hat on, was it a perfect company post-Benoit? Far from it. But did they get better in terms of athlete care, concussion awareness? They did. But Vince McMahon's views on concussions, this is the last person I would want handling, like, concussion protocols or being someone that I just... Whenever you and I talk, Way, about what would happen in the main event of WrestleMania if a guy got a concussion, it's like, this is the guy making the call? This guy calls into question Undertaker being concussed in that match with Brock Lesnar. Like, you went to the hospital with this guy, and he, Steve Austin, like, had a pretty, like, doesn't believe in CTE, which, I mean, man, that's, I'm not a CTE guy. I mean, dude, that's like saying I'm not a science guy. Like, I don't know. You can't come back with a response to that. But Steve Austin isn't running this company. Vince McMahon's like, I just thought, like, wow, this is some like pretty outdated thought process when it comes to concussion awareness and just the education. Like, this is, I don't know. I was stunned by just the comments by especially Vince McMahon, but Austin too on the concussion front.
I saw the Austin quote get picked up, maybe other than, you know, anything associated from Vince, but like, you know, anything other than Vince, I saw the Austin, I'm not a CTE guy quote picked up probably the most. And yeah, that was pretty shocking to hear from Austin, especially since, like, from what I remember and from what I've seen other people comment on, he's spoken plenty of times about the effects of his in-ring career on his body and his memory on his podcast. So I don't know why he said this. I mean, listen, like, we are watching a documentary with clips that are kind of presented. We don't exactly know what the questions are, but this particular sentence in talking about... you know, like, just to paraphrase, I think what he was saying, he says that he got knocked out once, and he said something to the effect of, if you're getting concussions in wrestling, you're not doing it wrong. And then, you know, saying to some extent, I don't believe in CTE, or I'm not a CTE guy. I want to know how that came about. I think he has to... I'd love for somebody to talk to him and to get follow-up from Steve Austin on that particular line, what he specifically means. You know, McMahon, at least you can point to the fact that he, you know, brought in Chris Nowinski and instituted a new policy to be able to say, like, okay, at least, like, McMahon addressed the issue in some way.
But even that, it's like they discredited, like, Nowinski at the beginning, you know, when he was when he was still working with Robert Cantu, and Dr. Amalu, who was the featured who Will Smith played in the movie Concussion, like, they were very much like, took it as though they were, like, under attack at first. Like, they tried to discredit Nowinski. McMahon even kind of does it in the documentary. Like, it was like this quack science, and it was
well, he did mention that Nowinski was attacking him, and so that's when he said he called Nowinski, and they ended up bringing him in, working with him.
Yeah, which I don't even know what the extent of their relationship is now. Like, it was like, if he is anyway, you know, all this came from, like, the Benoit talk, and, like, McMahon could not have been more dismissive of the idea that there was any link. And again, like, you cannot pin it down as, like, this was the reason. But the idea that this guy sustained head trauma, and just said, well, those diving headbutts, that's a work. It's a work.
It
just, to me, was an amazingly, I don't know, like, simple look at something much more complex.
Although I will say, like, at this point, even at this point, I would not have I wouldn't have expected McMahon to take any responsibility for the Benoit.
Well, that was consistent. Like, was there anything in this that he said he regrets
took responsibility for?
Said he would still run the Over the Edge show with Owen. Wouldn't have changed that. Didn't have. I mean, this was a guy that. He did not strike. He said many times, I look forward, and anything negative, you just move on.
Yeah.
And that seemed to be it. I just wanted to circle back. Like, so many of these interviews happened before the first set of Wall Street Journal articles in June of 2022. The end, which I guess you saw the first half of episode 6 or the last half?
Yeah.
The last half.
The first half.
Okay.
The first half.
Oh, you saw the first half. Okay. Well, at the end, I don't want to get ahead of where you are, but
please
Bruce Pritchard is offered up to them. It's 2 days before the Janelle Grant lawsuit is filed. And Bruce Pritchard, this is a weird comparison, but it reminded me of that TNA pay-per-view when WWE got Ric Flair to do the Hall of Fame that year, and in return, they sent Christian to be inducted into the TNA Hall of Fame. And if you remember that pay-per-view, Christian walks out. This man didn't have to say a word. He so did not want to be there. And that's what this felt like. Like, Bruce Pritchard was being offered up to the Wolves here to come back and do the follow-up interview. This is after the first set of, well, the first resignation of Vince, but by the time he's doing this interview, this is before the Grant lawsuit drops and the second resignation. And I mean, he just is asked, it's like, you've seen some of the rough cuts. Like, what do you think of the series so far? He's like, I hate this. I think it's awful. I think you're just, you know, Vince McMahon is not an asshole. And I mean, it's a,
someone that is very attached to Vince in Bruce Pritchard, but it's like, this guy was not going to say anything critical of Vince McMahon, like nothing.
Right.
And I just, that's kind of the trade-off is you get is that, you know, people are going to, you know, just when we look at like different people and the level of, you know, are people coming in here with, you know, preconceived notions or agendas. And it's like Bruce Pritchard's role here was pretty much to play defense for Vince. And I just, after 6 hours, I just didn't know how much insight you were really going to get, because this is someone that was just not going to say anything critical of Vince McMahon.
Right. Yeah. I do. So that is in line with the reports that we have out there or prior to this of, you know, Bruce Pritchard's role in it basically kind of playing somebody reflecting, breaking the fourth wall, maybe, you know, in some way talking about the actual thing that we're all watching. And I'm curious to know, like, why the director decided to include something like that here.
It's a great clip. I would have seriously put this in the trailer of him saying, I hate this series. Like, Bruce Pritchard saying he hates this series is as effective as that Vince McMahon statement on Monday.
I mean, it could just be that. You know, it could be a way for the producers to add a bit of extra credibility to say, like, for people that were curious about whether or not we would be unbiased enough for this documentary. Well, here's somebody who's attached to the company who hates it. And maybe that's just a sign of their own authenticity. Now, I do find it interesting that, like, Bruce Pritchard is somebody who's still very active in this company and will be working on a Netflix production. And here he is in a Netflix documentary, arguably looking some of the worst, you know, as somebody who's defending. And let's be fair to him. This interview was done before the specifics of the allegations, but not before.
This last interview is after we know about the Wall Street Journal once. This interview was January 2024. They put the date.
But before the lawsuit.
Before
with the
lawsuit
details.
Was filed. And, right. I mean, you know, Bruce Pritchard explains, you know, and, you know, like Bruce Pritchard explains the fact that Vince has greatly helped with the medical like expenses and issues with his wife. Like, he has an enormous, like, it's just it's a best friend that is on this. And that's what Bruce Pritchard's role is. But boom, it just cuts to the Janelle Grant lawsuit. And it's like, dude, Bruce Pritchard comes off like they did him no favor with that edit. I guess that was the trade off.
Is that an editing trick?
You know what? I watched this and it's like, yeah, if you I'm watching this and it's like, yeah, you might be annoyed by like B-roll that supports a particular line of questioning or to me, it's like I didn't watch this and felt like any of this was like unfair or underhanded. And certainly nothing approaching the level that I've seen on many WWE documentaries. So, listen, Vince McMahon, by the end of this, I thought that it was, listen, there's aspects where I felt you could have gone a lot harder on Vince McMahon. There's no question. There's areas,
you could have done a 6-part documentary series on several of the individual topics that were
easily
given 10 minutes.
You could definitely have done that. And they had to go through a lot. And you could have done episodes on this. Like Bill Simmons said they could have done 10 episodes on this. And there's hours of interview footage with Vince on the cutting room floor. That is, ultimately, I think for a lot of these subjects that want to be the focus of these, like, you understand why, what is in it for a Vince McMahon to volunteer himself where he is giving up the creative control aspect of it. And I think it's just, it's going to be few and far between where you see subjects of this level that hand over that ability to another, to producers that I'm just going to do it myself and I'm going to take out the bad parts and I'm going to produce the documentary on myself that I want.
he had every opportunity to do that while his company was, you know, he's got a documentary production, you know, arm of his company, or at least had for several years. At any time, he could have written his own book. He could have commissioned his own documentary series about himself, with him having control of final edit. This just seemed to present a very unique opportunity where he was willing to hand that off. And then all of this stuff happens to him that completely recolors his life story. And at that point, he no longer has control, but yet has already given up the rights. So the existence of this documentary even is, I think, pretty amazing. The fact that we've actually seen it, or at least, you know, most of us, or you have seen all of it, and I'm about to watch all of it now. So it's wonderful. I can't wait to dive deeper into every episode with you.
So again, Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, I'll be joined by Brandon Thurston and David Bixenspan. We will be extending this conversation and giving our thoughts on the series. And then beginning Friday, Wei and I are going to go episode by episode. Friday's show will be free, covering episode one, which Wei has watched. And then Saturday through next Wednesday, daily releases of The Double Shot at postwrestlingcafe.com. That will cover episodes 2 through 6. So those are, you will get daily Mr. McMahon Netflix coverage beginning tomorrow and running for the next week if you join the cafe. So looking forward to chatting more at length with you about these, Wei, once you, I am more curious to see what order you go in. Like, do you start episode 3, then you watch the back half of 4, circle back to 2.
Maybe I'll just, watch the first 10 minutes
the
of
non-linear
it'll be
direction
like
of Vince McMahon's life. Maybe, sure. Maybe way you have like multiple computers working in your brain along with a third computer.
I do get that. I did see that quote. I think we might leave feedback threads for every episode as well, just so we can get, you know, audiences' opinions on it, or at the very least for the final episode, perhaps, just because I'm sure people are going to watch everything and then they'll leave their thoughts. So we'll do that as well at the Post Wrestling Cafe.
Okay. We do have other news related to the Mr. McMahon series. And so let's go in order here. Ann Callis did put out a comment tonight about seeing the or at least whatever they had seen of it. And Ann Callis, the lawyer for Janelle Grant, wrote, "The Mr. McMahon docuseries makes it clear there is no difference between Vince McMahon's on-air persona and his true self. They are one and the same. His character, in quotations, known for violent outbursts, sexual deviance, and manipulation, is the real Vince McMahon, and exactly what Janelle Grant experienced behind closed doors at WWE for years. While the docuseries put McMahon's obsession with power and control on full display, it only scratches the surface of his criminal behavior, and it fails to tell the full story of his abuse, sexual assault, and human trafficking of Ms. Grant. She deserves the opportunity to tell her story on her own time and in her own way. We look forward to her day in court and seeing McMahon at last held accountable for his actions."
Okay, so I wonder if Ann Callis has seen all 6 episodes, or maybe she's only watched the relevant portions related to her.
Realistically, it's the last half hour of episode 6. I mean, Even episode 1, like, it's really cursory of just essentially, hey, this is what happened. We had filmed this documentary, and then we kind of go into what the documentary was going to be initially.
I wouldn't say, you know, much like Ann Callis's comments about the entire documentary series so far, I wouldn't say this is a shocking statement from her that reveals all too much. I mean, it's sort of a narrative that seems to support her client's case that this man is not a good person. And, now a lot more people know about it than they did 24 hours ago.
So going back to late Monday night, Matthew Bellany from Puck reported that Vince McMahon, at some point, after seeing a partial cut of the final documentary, tried to buy the rights back from Netflix. In theory, probably so this would not see the light of day. That would be my assumption. Or maybe he just wanted to have everyone over to his backyard to host it himself. This was turned down by Netflix, where apparently, Vince even leaned on Ari Emanuel to try and get the rights to this back. They don't state when this occurred, but it just says he did see a partial cut of the final documentary, which would seem to suggest this was more recent. Like, this was not, you know, over a year ago. But nevertheless, Netflix did not capitulate. And, I mean,
that tells you all you need to. I mean, it's an extension of Vince McMahon's statement. Like, he did not want this coming out. And when he's got a lot of liquid cash after, you know, selling a lot of his stock, and he would have had money to offer here.
Mm-hmm. So if Netflix did sell it back to him, I think it would have made Netflix look really bad and would have called into great question the credibility of their productions and their documentaries. But still, I think we have to, you know, give them some kudos for sticking to, you know, the sort of ethics, I guess, of their production. But it is a bit notable since Netflix is working with the WWE and them choosing to do this now.
Do you see WWE ever working with Ringer Films and Chris Smith again, like with the Bill Simmons connection? Bill Simmons has
potentially
exceptional ties with Nick Khan. Like, do you feel like
John, a bigger question is, now that you've seen all six episodes, do you think this documentary reflects poorly on modern day WWE?
No, I don't. I think
so. Then what's the harm in working with the Ringer?
I think this was much more in line with the WWE's. Like, I think this was much more in sync with WWE's messaging this year of Vince McMahon was the problem. Vince McMahon is gone. And this is a new company under new leadership. I mean, they did not go into, I don't even know, like, they made no emphasis on WWE being defendants in this lawsuit, or like nothing brought up with John Laurinaitis. Like, there was, or anything about like Vince McMahon communicating through Bruce Prichard during that whole first resignation. Like, none of that was brought up. Like, WWE, if you were Nick Khan or Mark Shapiro or Paul Levesque even watching this, you come out of this with feeling your hands are dirty.
Okay. The only attachment might be Bruce Prichard.
Bruce Prichard did not come off great in this. I don't think it's enough that he will be like, the scourge of WWE as a result of this. But he is the biggest Vince McMahon apologist in this entire series.
Sure. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, given that, I don't see the harm in them choosing to work with either the Ringer or, the director of this film. But what topics, you know, would they suggest? Beyond that, do you see WWE acknowledging this documentary at all on its TV?
No, I don't.
So despite the fact that you think most almost everybody comes out of this looking fine, it's still too hot of a topic?
It's not. When I say coming out fine, it's like I don't think anyone that was coming into this already with a see no evil, speak no evil view of WWE, that like I don't think there's anything in here that just makes it unconscionable for fans of WWE to continue supporting this. But seeing everything laid out and the history of this company and all the scandals attached to it, like, yeah, if you want, you can just put all of that. It's all Vince McMahon that was the problem. That, to me, is a real simplistic conclusion to reach, but a lot of people will draw that conclusion. It was, like Dave Meltzer said it perfectly in one of the answers, that fans want entertainment. They are not sitting down to judge moral fiber. They want their entertainment. That's it. And that's a pretty easy transaction for a lot of fans that are not going to feel guilt over, you know, but it is a lot when you put everything in context in order and it's just one thing after the other. It's kind of amazing that this company is where it is and some of the things it survived, like the Ring Boy scandal. Like, it's just, I don't think they survived that today. If that were to come around, I would feel very strongly in that.
I guess these are some of the privileges you take when you're the biggest leader in town, and in for many of those years, the only company in town.
For some. Other notes here that we'll get to is the news that was first reported today by the Wrestling Observer site, that after Brandon Thurston had reported earlier this week that Vince McMahon was no longer being represented by Citric & Company, he has now learned that the Observer first reported that his new crisis management firm is Edendale Strategies, who will represent him moving forward. We have
also confirmed that here at Post Wrestling. And comes Edendale Strategies is marketing itself as a consulting firm focused on communications, counsel, and crisis management, stating that its goal is to help clients hone and convey their messaging effectively, especially in high-stakes situations where there is little to no margin for error. Meltzer also reports that McMahon's decision to hire Edendale Strategies came from his belief that the company had a stronger grasp of modern media, including digital and modern reporting. So interesting the timing of all this that, you know, he has switched PR firms going into. We had that statement that came out Monday and, you know, and this series. So will we have more of a public discourse from Vince McMahon coming out of this series? I don't know.
So this is an insinuation that it was McMahon's call to leave Citric and Company?
That's the impression I got. I can't state that for 100% certainty, but it certainly sounds like Vince McMahon made this call.
For not being digital and not as good of a grasp of modern media, including digital and modern reporting. So is he going to do TikToks now, or you know, what can we expect?
I don't know, but all I will say, like, I read the guy's book and have had, like, communication.
Michael Citric.
Yeah, Mike Citric is considered, like, pretty high up in this field. Like, he's a heavyweight in this industry.
What were some of his clients, notably?
Oh, I mean, he's represented Kobe Bryant. He has represented Pepsi. He has represented tons of names.
And attempted, or at least for a period, represented Harvey Weinstein. Correct.
Did represent Harvey Weinstein, represented R. Kelly, like a lot of, you know, problematic figures as well, but has also represented other kind of, like, you know, Fortune 500 companies as well. Like, he's been doing this for decades as well.
Right.
And very interesting guy if you read up on him.
Yeah. I don't know. That sounds like it's tough to find better than that guy when you're going through a crisis management. But yeah, we'll see if this Edendale does any better with McMahon. I think they have their work cut out for him. Support for this Post Wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from Post Wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MC Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chop-tees.com/postwrestling.
All right. Some ratings notes, Wei. We'll get back to some normal ratings notes. Let's start with Raw, which did 1,339,000 viewers, which was one of their lowest numbers ever. It was down 11% this week, but the demo did not experience as much lower on the history of its demographic performance. They did a 0.43, which was down 12%. This was going up against two NFL games, which combined did around 20 million viewers. I would say the positive to this number is that it was a very unusual pattern where in the demo, it grew from hour one to hour two to hour three. And for the whole show, in terms of overall viewership, the usual decline is around 15% from hour one to hour two. On Monday, it fell 2% throughout the show. Again, the overall viewership was not great, but the demo performed really well. It was only beaten by the ESPN game. To me, and I haven't seen the full breakdown of the quarters, but to me, that would suggest that there was it's a credit to Jey Uso, I would think, like going for the title, because this is not the kind of retention you typically see over the course of 3 hours. So I think after all these years, I think maybe the 3-hour format could work.
You know, I know you're kidding, but we may have a lot of more 3-hour shows
you never know. Yes. But anyway, that was the numbers for Monday, and the final NXT on the USA Network, 620,000 viewers and a 0.19 in the demo, down from last week, 8% in viewership, down 10% in the demo. But it was third in primetime on cable behind the WNBA playoff game and Gutfeld on Fox News.
Oh, Gutfeld.
They couldn't catch Gutfeld. Favorite. Yes.
All eyes on the CW next week for their debut.
Big debut next week, and I think it's going to be a very strong number. They promoted those two shows very, very strongly. And the last note is that this coming Sunday, New Japan is back with Destruction in Kobe, which is headlined by Tetsuya Naito against Great Okan, which just feels like a very... it's the match before Naito defends the title against Zack Sabre Jr. that everyone is looking toward. And this is a main event where we will see how Naito looks post-G1 after a month off, at least from big singles matches. David Finlay...
He did the TJP
match. TJP he did on Capital Collision. But that was about a month ago.
Was it?
Yeah. That was the end of August, right. I think. David Finlay defends the global heavyweight title against Yoshihashi. Hanare versus Shingo Takagi. That should be outstanding for the NEVER title. Doki versus Yoshinobu Kanemaru for the junior heavyweight title. NEVER six-man titles. Hiroshi Tanahashi, Oleg Bolton, and Tori Yano against the House of Torture. TMDK, where they will introduce a new member to join Zack Sabre Jr. and Kosei Fujita against Sonata, Taichi, and Taka. Gabe Kidd against Hirooki Goto. LIJ against the United Empire in an eight-man or a six-man tag. And opening things up, it's Yuji Nagata, Honma, and Tiger Mask against Dragon Daya, Ryusuke Taguchi, and Shota Umino. So that is a Destruction in Kobe, which Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson will be reviewing this coming weekend.
Yeah, so a lot of bonus content coming out in the Post Wrestling Cafe this week.
Yes. So again, the reminder, beginning Friday, we will have episode one for free for everyone covering the first Mr. McMahon episode, and then 2 through 6 coming Saturday through Wednesday, postwrestlingcafe.com. $6 gets you in the door for all of our ramblings and thoughts about this six-hour series.
Oh, we will ramble.
Yes, and I'm sure we will have plenty of Paul Heyman clips to reference.
Ooh, lovely.
Paul Heyman was in fine form. As was AEW tonight, where they managed to top 8,000 tickets distributed for this show. Some real significant movement over the last few days. Like when we talked on Monday night, they had just passed 6,000. The last update from WrestleTix, 8,191. There was a pretty decent push I saw. It was interesting. It seemed that I saw Willow do some media, and I saw Mercedes Moné all over the place doing media, which was curious because she wasn't even on like tonight's show. So it's like you're sending her out without really anything to promote other than the show is happening itself. But notable nonetheless. And listen, they topped 8,000 that I would not have predicted a week ago they would have been able to hit. I would not call this a grand slam nor a home run when it comes to, like, they pretty much, you could see the setup tonight, like, pretty much half the building was cut off.
Do you have the number from last year?
11,263 was the final number for last year. Obviously, nothing like year one, which was like 20,000. But you know what? To get to 8,000, I call it a solid double, okay?
That's a solid double. Yeah, okay.
Solid double.
Any runs batted in?
No runs batted in, but a standing double. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Our announcers, Excalibur, Tony Schiavone, and Taz, and bookending the show was Jim Ross, who was in for the first and final match. And Nigel McGuinness comes out. Oasis kicks us off, Way, as he comes out. And man, right up until the finish line, Tony Schiavone stating there is no guarantee Bryan Danielson will be here tonight. No one's seen him all day. His music begins, but no one's out. So Nigel calls him the American coward who just dropped the ball. He wants a 10 count and to be declared the winner and for Danielson to be stripped of the title. And they go to make the final countdown when Europe plays at Arthur Ashe Stadium and cleared from his near suffocation, Bryan Danielson walks out. He made it.
Yes.
He made it. The asterisk can be erased. If you bought a ticket, you were rewarded.
He wanted to make a dramatic entrance, clearly, you know, and maybe just stepped right from the doctor's office, got cleared, got his Europe cleared as well, and out he came.
Yes. How's my breathing function after that plastic bag? Have I been cleared for full breathing during a 19-minute match?
Well, yeah, I wonder what the recovery process is after a suffocation.
Deep breathing, meditation.
Deep breathing, yeah. Meditation. Well, I think he does that.
So the match begins, and I mean, the place is going wild here at the site of Danielson, and we're just starting things off. They're just immediately going into all these great transitions that they're having, and Nigel is, dude, this guy is 48, and like it's one thing that, you know, Danielson like missed all of these years when he wasn't cleared. It's another for Nigel, who it's like he missed. He's been doing magic. And for 13 years, it was just like he did not have the financial incentive to continue his career. And here this guy is that, I mean, I was just thinking about that watching his promo on Saturday at the end of Collision. It's like, man, the quality of work that this guy could have been doing. And granted, he went through a lot of like injuries and such. But I mean, look at this guy.
But he's done some great quality of work on the commentary desk, you know, and we wouldn't have had that, you know, if he continued his in-ring career. So, yeah, life works out in unexpected ways, and I'm just very glad he's getting to write this final chapter.
Well, the focus of Nigel's attack is the right arm of Danielson, that he runs into the steps, and they semi-recreate their spot where Danielson grabs the wrists of Nigel, and instead of clunking his head into the post, instead he just rammed the shoulder of Nigel. I don't know what they had to be worried about. I mean, Steve Austin would have told them, like, guys, just ram your head in. I think both these guys are CTE guys.
Yeah.
So Danielson gets put into the London dungeon, but escapes that and lands with the running drop kick, all while like his right arm is pretty much just useless. Lands to Busaiku, but can't capitalize for the cover. And Nigel does a headstand into the corner, and Danielson places the head on top of the turnbuckle and twists his neck like he's a chiropractor here. And Nigel rotates off the back of Danielson into a clothesline, hits the Les Kellett lariat for a one count, and the crowd just roars as Danielson slaps the mat and is caught by a ripcord lariat. Danielson is rotated backwards in the corner into the Tower of London. This setup was amazing for the spot. And Danielson hits his own Les Kellett lariat, but only gets gets caught with a lariat from Nigel. So Nigel's arm is just laying there, and Danielson pounces on it, going for the lapel lock, but he's struggling to get the grip because of the power that's lost in the right arm. So instead, he's got to grab his wrist instead of going for the fingers. And he manages to get Nigel to submit. Right before the tap, Nigel yells out, "Thank you!" And Jim Ross right on top of it. Did he just say thank you? And the finish comes at 18 minutes and 51 seconds. And they circled back to Danielson doing this a year ago with Okada when he had the broken arm and managed to submit him in Toronto. So I thought a really entertaining match that these two had. Was it their top level? I wouldn't say it hit that, but I thought this was pretty great. And I just thought, like, for Nigel McGuinness, like, this is his first singles match he's had in 13 years. He goes 19 minutes, and I thought it was pretty extraordinary for that fact.
It really is amazing. I don't know if I wanted something that matched their initial run.
Well, no one wanted the head spots, and neither did these two. So,
yeah,
I was happy to see that omitted. I
thought this was great as its own thing. You know, Nigel looked excellent here. Technically, working his particular style, I think you could slot him right now into the current roster and he'll feel completely deserving of a spot. You know, never would you be able to tell that this man had the layoff that he had. I thought his heel work was excellent. He definitely looked like he, you know, had the instincts of a veteran, being able to control the crowd very confidently through his mannerisms. I was also really heartened to hear this crowd give this match a very high level of reverence, like even before the bell. You know, they recognized that what they were seeing was special and a part of like a long legacy. They also gave really great reactions to a lot of Nigel's signature spots. The rebound lariat, like they reacted like it was like they all knew that he was an originator. The callback to the headbutt received a good reaction as well. So like
the London Dungeon spot, like Excalibur was excellent in this match, of just all the callback spots and what this meant, like submitting Danielson or making Danielson pass out to the London Dungeon.
like either you had 8,000 people who all bought ROH DVDs or iPay-per-views, or these people were doing their research, or they were watching these video packages online over the past week. But no matter what, this was an effective match to make, and the callbacks all worked really well for this particular audience. And those reactions weren't really guaranteed, I would say, because Nigel is still a relative unknown, I would say, compared to a lot of the members of this roster. Certainly, like, you know, compared to Danielson's opponents, the style of match they were going for itself is a lot more ground-based and not necessarily as fan-friendly as, you know, a Will Ospreay match, for instance. But this turned out to be a great match for this particular crowd. The finish, I felt, was maybe missing a bit more of a crescendo, in my opinion, and climax. That's just kind of maybe, in my opinion, how modern audiences tend to react. But maybe they're just going for something that was a bit more... I don't know, realistic. Though I did love the overdramatic thank you at the end. I thought it added, added a nice little sort of, like, you know, sentimental value to the match. And I'd love to hear Nigel give us a follow-up promo or something to maybe expand on whatever thoughts he was thinking as he was saying that.
What if Danielson instead had applied the million-dollar dream and instead he whispered to Nigel, "Don't dream, it's over." From the music video that fan created.
Oh, okay. I don't know if I saw the whole thing or remember it as well.
That was the song that they used.
Oh, okay. Okay. I'm sorry.
Never mind. I tried.
So
Christian walks out with his contract and he's about to sign it when Kip Sabian sneaks up and steals his pen. I'm not kidding. And he runs to the back and Cage sprints to the back, and there are Claudio and Pac awaiting. What they were waiting for, we don't know. They just stood there.
Well, they have an interest to protect for John Moxley because, you know, Moxley's target is Danielson.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did Kip, how far did he get away with the pen?
I'm assuming pretty far. Well, I mean, long enough for the moment
he should
to
get,
pass.
He should get an electronic signature and be just always have it ready on a drive to
So if Kip Sabian signed the contract, would he get the title shot?
That's how it usually works in wrestling, yes.
Right. So now we know the sort of mechanics of this cash-in contract. Christian has to bring the contract out and has to physically sign it on the spot in order for the match to be valid.
Yeah.
He can't sign it beforehand, okay? I'm guessing what does he have to write? The location? I want to cash in at...
His emergency contact.
He's got to do all that.
Is he cleared? He probably needs something for the New York State Athletic Commission.
Gotcha. So as long as the signature is not on the contract, then the match is not valid. So the key to it is the pen.
Yeah. What if he gets... I guess as soon as he signs it, the match is official, right? So if he signs this and then gets thwarted, like, what, is the match go up in smoke?
Pretty much, yeah. Okay. I think Christian should carry multiple pens.
He should have a Sharpie at the very least all times.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not really loving any of this cash-in shenanigans, especially, like, I'm sorry, but, like, having Kip Sabian attached to it just makes this feel so much lower than I think it should be. You know, we're talking about world championship challenger here, at least when compared to, like, a Jon Moxley who just, you know, it's serious. We're talking about a guy who just had a bag, you know, stuffed over his head. This sort of, like, comical tone of, like, a Christian cash-in tease, I don't feel threatened by it at all.
Hook and Roderick Strong for the FTW Championship. I think this one got, like, bounced around because I think the last update, this was going to be on Collision. But anyway, it ended up here tonight. And they were doing Collision tapings before and I think after as well. So they were not doing the full 2 hours after Dynamite because that has been a criticism in the past of very late nights. And it's a Wednesday. So... Strong is out with Taven and Bennett, and early on, they rescue him to the floor, and Hook goes after all three. There's a kendo stick involved, some very big chops here, and then the Red Rum gets stopped when Hook's head is rammed into a chair, and two chairs get set up, but then it's Hook with the Sayanagi, as Taz identifies it, throwing Roderick onto the two chairs. Roderick comes back with a gut buster on the chair and a sick kick for two. Then the end of Heartache gets countered into the Red Rum and Hook submits him at 8 minutes and 57 seconds. Roderick puts out his hand. Hook is looking skeptical, but shakes the hand and Roderick gives him a hug and mutual respect at the end of this. And I have to say, I thought I thought Roderick was a great opponent for Hook in this match. I was pleasantly surprised by, a 9-minute Hook match, and I thought that this was a good match that the two had.
It was good, yeah. Both of them are very physical, in their styles. And Hook threw this guy around, and Strong took it pretty well. Very entertaining matchup. I would say maybe the feud didn't feel all that important to me. Maybe that kind of affected my own personal connection to it. In retrospect, though, this was a pretty significant match.
It was a very historical moment that we weren't aware of, because Schiavone speaks with Hook, noting that in 1998, 3 miles from here at the Elks Lodge, the FTW Championship was introduced. And Hook says, "All good things must come to an end." And he thanks everyone that ever competed for this title, the fans that supported it. He is retiring this championship, a first in AEW, and states that he is handing it over to the man that introduced this title, his father. And he gives Taz a hug, and dude, Taz was this is the moment that all fathers and sons should be able to share, coming off today's documentary.
That I guess a moment that after seeing your son get suplexed onto a chair, he hands you the world championship that you created.
He said
20 something years ago,
"Dad, together you and I, we fuck the world."
Yes.
That's the end of the FTW title. I mean, when does this company ever sunset titles?
Oh, never. I also don't think it's the end, John. I think someday Hook will have children, and that's when we can see the return of the FTW.
Maybe we'll get an FT and W title. They're going to splinter this.
F fuck the and the world title. Okay,
three different belts coming out of this. They'll just
one for each letter. Yeah, gotcha. Yeah. To me, I thought the most significant thing about this entire thing was getting to hear Hook speak a bit more at length. You know, delivering
Book Arthur Ashe Stadium every month and just go back with Hook. I thought he came off really well here. Like, I know some people are not the biggest like Hook supporters. I'll say this for him: is he the smoothest guy? No. But he's also got a style that is like so unique to him. You know what I mean? Like, it's...
Are you talking about on the mic or in ring?
In ring. Not so much on the mic. But it's like he's got his own style that's very much exclusively his. And for me, more and more, what I'm looking for is different and unique from certain people. And I think Hook, is he a finished product? Far from it. But he has a style that I like, that it's like it's a different type of match and a different type of like offense, and it's a great compliment to have Taz that can call all the judo spots.
Completely, yeah. I think Hook is great. You know, as an original product in AEW, I definitely think he stands out. I think his where he lacks the most is his development as somebody on the microphone. Now, I don't need every single person to be a great, give me like a 5-minute promo. Like, I don't think he should be trying to sound like his dad, who is one of those guys. He should develop his own voice, and I think they've been trying that through like the very unique video packages that they shoot for him. Even in like a setting like this, where like, you know, it's kind of like short and sweet, tells you exactly like directly what he wants to say. Almost like this was oddly emotional, I would say, for a Hook promo, where he had to kind of talk about his dad and like give his dad a hug. But even that, he did it in a way that felt very like, I'm going to show a little bit of emotion, and I'm just going to get the fuck out of there, you know, like, and eat my chips. I think they need to continue to foster that unique voice onto himself. And I hope that it means, you know, they're not trying to fit him into like the style of what we might consider a classic promo.
And then buckle up for the AEW tag title match between the Young Bucks against Will Ospreay and Kyle Fletcher. Don Callis is on commentary, and we are getting immediately into things with double Orihara moonsaults from the challengers, and the Bucks then cut off Kyle Fletcher in the ring. They have the advantage for several moments before Ospreay is brought in, and they redid what we recently saw with the Swanton by Nick, bouncing Ospreay into a sit-out powerbomb from Nick, and then he avoids the EVP trigger, landing a double Os cutter, and Rick Knox is just like a deer in a headlights here, not knowing who's legal, and he pauses and is delayed in making the count, which the Bucks kick out of, and the ref, everyone got mad at Rick Knox. And then we saw a sequence where Nick countered a Liger bomb to hit a face buster on Fletcher.
He lands on his back for a 450 from Ospreay off the top. Matt follows with a Canadian destroyer to Will, who lands on his feet, nailing the hidden blade, and all four go down. And this place just gave it a standing ovation as all four are down. And it just intensified from then. Some of the highlights included a TK driver, which was caught when Nick flipped in the air by Ospreay, who hits him and Fletcher hit double Styles clashes for a massive near fall. Then there's a hidden blade to Matt and a Stormbreaker Nick saves. He teases the Tiger driver 91, but is cut off with a super kick. Ospreay then prevents a TK driver with a springboard cutter, and the challengers hit their own TK driver to Matt. Another big near fall. Coriolis, another kick out. They hit a turnbuckle brainbuster on Matt Jackson, who survives this when Nick tackles Ospreay on top of them. And this place is just on fire. Callis then says, you know what? If they can't win with a top rope brainbuster, it's time to bring out the screwdriver. So we get the screwdriver handed to Fletcher, and Fletcher looks at it, hesitates, but says, eh, might as well. And he goes into the ring to use it when Ospreay stops Fletcher and hands it to the referee, and we get belt shots to both men. Fletcher still manages to kick out before a double super kick and EVP trigger keep Kyle Fletcher down at 19 minutes and 27 seconds, as Fletcher cannot understand why Ospreay got in the way and stopped them from winning the tag titles. One of the best matches you are going to see, at least on television this year, but I thought this match was just out of this world incredible.
Feels like we say that every month about a Will Ospreay match, but not as often in a tag team setting. As far as like a quality of tag team wrestling match goes, like this feels like you could confidently call it in the top like 0.1% of any tag team match that you might be watching. It was outstanding. I mean, I think it had that same incredible, like almost imaginative and almost unthinkable type of creativity that you get from Ospreay and Bucks matches. So many flawlessly timed counters and sequences, in particular from Will Ospreay, but it's Kyle Fletcher that I think benefits the most from, you know, this showcase.
He was incredible in this match too. Like,
we already know like the top level of quality that you get from like a Bucks and Ospreay match, but like Kyle Fletcher is somebody who's continuing to show that he's capable of hanging at the very top of the industry when it comes to this high flying style. He's amazing. I even like the Callis finish here. You know, like the screwdriver stuff, I'm kind of iffy on from time to time, especially when a quality of in-ring content is this good. But I thought to give this match a bit of added story coming out of it, I thought it was actually perfectly utilized, especially in the way that the Bucks managed to play around with the belt shot afterwards, and the way that they played with the, you know, Fletcher being pissed off as a way to, you know, take us to the next chapter of this story. I thought it was all very well done.
Yeah. Interesting, like no Ricochet on this show. Like there was a lot of matches to get to. And I mean, they did promote that it's the match next week. I'm hoping there's something on Collision, whether it's like a backstage thing or at least something to kind of just give that the extra oomph for next week. But, unbelievable match, like seriously one of the better matches this year. I just thought this was outstanding,
man. Like it really is an incredible run that Will Ospreay is on, where every single week we might be talking about just one of the best matches we've seen all year. Yeah. From this guy.
Listen, the first hour and 15 minutes of this show I thought was as good as any show AEW's done like on TV this year. I just thought this show was incredible up to this point. And at 9:15, it's our first and only backstage segment of the entire night, where Renee is with the Conglomeration, who officially welcome Rocky Romero into the group. And Mark Briscoe, who is wearing a Dem Boys shirt, explains that it was only a few miles away that him and Jay had their final match together, and said that they are going to give the Learning Tree an ass whooping on Collision. And the word of the day is vociferous.
That it was. Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Shivani welcomes Prince Nana to give us an update on Swerve. And he states that mentally, there is nothing that can stop Swerve, but physically,
he is not cleared to come back yet. So, man, one guy gets cleared, the other's still waiting. And then out walks Montel Vontavious Porter. And everyone suddenly realizes who it is, and they're all buzzing for MVP, who just cut the best promo on this show.
Awesome.
He agrees Swerve is the most dangerous man in AEW, the most phenomenal talent to step foot in an AEW ring, a man whose 2024 will be studied by future generations, and goes through all of his victims this year, but 2024 also saw him lose the title and have his childhood home burned to the ground, and asks why the man who did this is walking around smiling and not in the ICU. He doesn't blame Swerve for this. He blames it on Swerve's management. And Nana has this reaction that is priceless. He says, "You're more concerned with selling coffee," and hands him over his business card to pass along to Swerve. And when he's ready, we can talk business.
Hmm.
Man, this guy came in and just, I thought this promo was outstanding for an introductory promo from this guy who's always been a great promo. Hit this one out of the park. And I think you have a lot of people that are thinking that MVP coming in, Lashley cannot be far away. And I'm a little torn on that one. I don't know if Lashley is the guy you really need at this point coming in. All I can say is they are building quite the 48-year-old division to have to build around.
Yeah. But he doesn't look 48.
No, you know? I mean,
Lashley.
I don't care as much about the age. What it is, though, it's like it is another big name that you're having here in the midst. But listen,
probably a big contract as well.
I mean, it's. But we all say that without even knowing, like, what is the amount of TV they're even going to be producing in 6 months from now. But we will see.
Yeah.
In terms of just an introduction, though, of MVP, I thought this was great.
Oh, this was an outstanding debut from MVP. It was the type of debut that made you wonder why he hasn't been more utilized over the past year, you know, for the WWE. I would say maybe 2 years at this point, you know, for the WWE. This was a wonderful way to introduce him into a big time storyline for Swerve. And I thought MVP made some really good points here. Like, he, in a promo like this, he did more to put Swerve over than Prince Nana has ever done in any sort of promo we've ever heard from him. But that said, I like that Nana is getting the chance now to actually get a storyline to build his character, because for the longest time, he was really just a caricature of a Ganon prince. And beyond that, a guy who just is there to dance. We don't really know that much about him. Now he is actually getting a chance to tell story. So I'm looking forward to that. I think this I'm assuming a lot of people are expecting this to end with Swerve staying loyal to Nana, leading to MVP bringing in a Bobby Lashley, maybe even a Shelton as well. But man, like, this was a great start for him. I'm kind of with you on like Bobby Lashley's inclusion on the roster, but I love the idea of a Lashley versus Swerve feud as a way to elevate Swerve. You know, like, Swerve needs somebody right now as a babyface coming back, who is sort of on that higher level and feels like, you know, would be a big opponent for him. And I think Bobby Lashley definitely fulfills that. And beyond that, I'm curious to know if, like, MVP would be attached to anybody else on this roster, because I think he's already a very valuable commodity in this company. You know, a lot of guys on this roster can use somebody who can talk for them and who understands how to get people over like him.
Yeah, I think MVP is a great asset in that regard. Jack Perry is shown driving into the city for Collision for his open challenge. Mariah May and Yuka Sakazaki for the AEW women's title. So Sakazaki jumps her before the bell off the apron and lands a rolling elbow. May cuts her off with a shotgun dropkick. And then Mayday is countered into a sunset roll up. And we go for a backslide, but it didn't seem that Mariah May kicked out of this. And the crowd immediately like jumped on this.
What happened here?
I don't know. There were a lot of problems in this match.
You know, we were talking about Yuka Sakazaki, the uncrowned AEW Women's Champion.
Yes.
Right now.
Very high-angle German by Mariah May. They were really struggling to get the crowd, who had just, you know, gone through some, especially two really big matches in this last hour. There was, they did subside here. And then Mariah tries for a spinning side slam, and all I can say is she did not hit this. And then is hit with a Northern Lights bomb by Yuka, who goes for the Magical Girl Splash, lands on the knees, and May hits a running knee and Storm Zero to win the match. I thought these two really struggled. I thought like there were points where it felt like they were fighting in quicksand with one another, and then you had the three count, or well, not the three count, but the shoulders down, the side slam spot. I just thought these two, and I had high hopes for this with Yuka Sakazaki having this title match, but this was easily the weakest match on the show.
I thought it was going relatively well until some of the sloppiness over the Phantom cover and then that messy swinging, whatever they were going for. And then unfortunately a finish that wasn't all that climactic either. But overall, like I feel like I saw enough from Yuka Sakazaki to feel like I want to see more of her in a regular role in AEW. I think she's good in ring. She's very charismatic despite not cutting many promos at all during her time in AEW. So I would love to see them continue to build more with her. And it looks like from the end of this segment that they are going to.
Well, there's a lot coming your way here. So Willow Nightingale comes out to a very good reaction. Then Mina Shirakawa's music plays, and this distracts Willow, who gets nailed with a belt shot. But Mina looks conflicted here, like she did not mean to distract. But based on wrestling history, you have to know music is the easiest method to distract someone, and their attention gets taken away. So Mariah runs up to hug Mina, who's got this confused look on her face. Then Yuka goes after Mariah May and gets into Mina's face. So we just got a whole plethora of directions here. This was a lot that they crammed into the, like, literally 60 seconds after this match.
It's leading to some form of tag match, I guess we could suspect. I think there is some insinuation that, like, Yuka and Mina are friends, and Mina has to choose now between the two of them or something. Yeah.
No celebration either, unless this was considered the title celebration.
Oh, this was certainly not it. No, okay, so that's the cover.
We're still waiting. And then the main event, John Moxley with Marina Shafir taking on Darby Allin. Jim Ross returns for commentary. Moxley's first match since Forbidden Door 3 months ago. And Darby comes out with a picture of Moxley. It's like half of Moxley's face, half of a skeleton on his skateboard. And Moxley drills this guy immediately. And within record time, Darby's mouth is all busted open. With blood. There was so much here that I almost thought it had to have been like a capsule, but then I realized who this was, and I'm sure it wasn't.
I'm thinking it was a capsule, just maybe given like the location of the blood, also maybe how bright it was, and also the fact that we're in New York.
True. I feel they've done blood in New York, though, have they not?
I mean, not that I think it's ever a limiting factor for a company as big as AEW.
It certainly looked like a capsule. I just looking at Darby, I could imagine it, and it did play into the finish in a bit of a way. So anyway, he's bleeding from the mouth in whatever form, and finally, after Darby is just dominated here at the start, he places Mox's arm into the ring post on top. Marina gets it out, and a coffin drop is executed to the floor. And Shafir is going after Darby when the referee is distracted, and it's back to Moxley in control when he gets nailed by a stunner and then a missile dropkick as he is seated on a chair on the floor. Shafir then pulls up the padding on the floor, so exposes the floor where they play tennis. And this leads to Darby going for a tope suicida and no water in the pool as he crashed onto the floor and is just laying there. And Moxley picks up Darby and hits a bitter end on top of the steps. And Excalibur reminds us that it was in New York earlier this year where Darby was hit by a bus. And this time in New York, hit by a bus named John Moxley. The crowd chants, "You can't kill him." Darby making as strong an argument in the against this. And a coffin drop lands in the rear naked choke. Moxley turns to a bulldog choke, and we get a zoom in of Darby foaming at the mouth as he makes his way to the rope. And then they fight on top, where a superplex gets countered with Moxley hitting an avalanche death rider for the win, and thus will challenge Bryan Danielson at WrestleDream.
Mm-hmm. good match. Yeah. Darby Allin is crazy. This had, I think, what we've come to expect from all of his matches, where the man took some really, really crazy bumps. A lot of creativity from the both of them, as usual. Now, is it like the type of match that, like, I'll remember from either of them? Maybe not, because I've seen such crazy matches from the both of them. But it, I would say it lived up to, I think, your expectations of what a Darby versus Mox match was. I think Mox continues to just like convey this really, really mean, serious heel character that I think definitely feels like it's a great challenge for Danielson to headline a pay-per-view for.
Yeah, this one went around 20 minutes or so. I mean, there was a bit of a lull here with the crowd throughout, like, a lot of the heat from Moxley. I would place this as like the number three match on tonight's show, behind Danielson Nigel in the tag title match. But a good match that they had overall, and kind of established.
What do you think about the placement of the matches on the show?
This was kind of what I anticipated them doing, because I thought that they would want to do Danielson coming out at the end to establish the main event and do something with the first confrontation, right, of the BCC. And that's what they did here. Danielson shows up in a hoodie and starts choking John Moxley. At first, I thought he had a purple belt, but it was actually a tie. Yeah. So
maybe it was Justin Roberts' tie.
I guess so. It was kind of a, I guess. Did we need the callback here? Did we need the callback to the tie?
Well, listen, this was supposed to be in retaliation for the plastic bag, which is like one of the scariest looking visuals we've ever seen in this company. The tie feels kind of cute to me.
That's what,
like,
I felt.
Just, yeah, like it didn't feel as threatening as the plastic bag. Although, yes, if you're choking somebody with the tie, yes, okay, I'm sure it would be very scary. But because of like the way Justin Roberts sold it with his tongue hanging out, and that's how I think Mox was trying to call back to it too, with its tongue hanging out, like it felt more comedic in tone to me.
Yeah, it's like sometimes I like when there's references to things that it's like, okay, this is, if you get the reference, it's a bonus, but I'm not doing it strictly for that reason. And this felt like this was strictly because of the Justin Roberts thing from, God, 14 years ago. But nevertheless, Marina Shafir breaks this up, and then we get the cavalry running in. The BCC are in. No Wheeler Yuta out here, but then he gets his other backup, Private Party and Commander, as Claudio saves Moxley from a Busaiku, and Danielson declares war on John Moxley and threatens to kick his fucking head in at Wrestle Dream. And they get a second play of the Final Countdown, an expensive night for AEW. And the end, they note that Claudio, Pac, and if they can find him, Wheeler Yuta will defend the Trios belts on Collision against Private Party and Commander.
All right.
With one hand for Brother Zay.
Oh, yeah. Did he have his hand bandage? I assume he did.
Well, that was quite the hammer. So there you go. That was AEW Grand Slam, that I thought overall was a very strong show. In particular, the tag title match, that was just, you're not going to find too many free matches this year at that level. That was just something else. And I thought Nigel Danielson was excellent. You know, it was, I would say the only match to me that really didn't hit was the women's title match, but this was a pretty much bell-to-bell wrestling show. I mean, there was very little outside of, like, the segment with MVP and Nana. That was...
Yeah, and that was pretty significant, just for, you know, being able to see the debut of MVP. But, yeah, I thought top to bottom, this was a very, very fast-moving and very entertaining 2 hours with, depending on, I think, how attached you were to Danielson versus Nigel, like, it gave you great sentimentality, you know, in a dream match scenario or dream rematch scenario. Gave you a potential tag team match of the year in Young Bucks versus Ospreay and Fletcher, and gave you like the hardcore that I think you might have been wanting out of a John Moxley versus Darby Allin match as well.
All right, those were our thoughts on the episode from tonight, and we will go to your feedback now. If people are throwing in stuff for the Mr. McMahon series, again, refer to forum.postwrestling.com. We will put up threads there. So we'll avoid getting, unless people have anything pressing there. But anyway, let us go to feedback.
Okay. Well, I'll leave it up to your discretion when you want to answer some of the questions. But the first one comes to us from Robert Pearson, who is actually in attendance. And he actually says this. worst live show experience ever. I left 25 minutes in and I had a front row seat. It's sad to see how careless the production has become and how little the fan experience means to Tony Khan.
Oh, wow.
So I've actually asked Robert Pearson privately to expand on it. I don't exactly know what he's specifically referring
to. Yeah, I'd be curious of like what that was. Obviously, we can't really relate to the live experience for those there.
Yeah. Now, is he meaning the first 25 minutes of Nigel versus Brian, or did he not even make it, and he's only speaking about his collision experience?
Yeah, no, because they were taping stuff beforehand, so I don't know. Maybe Robert can expand on us, but there you go, one unsatisfied customer.
All right, well, maybe we'll hear from Robert soon enough. Let's go up next to Chris from LA, who sends $10 to say, I work in crisis management. So maybe you'll be getting a call.
Yeah,
maybe, if it doesn't work
Chris,
out.
If it doesn't work out, maybe you will get the call, but you will have to disclose that if you do.
But of course, I'm very curious to hear Chris Ely's thoughts on the entire McMahon series the next time we get to hear from him on the NWA podcast. And then lastly, let's go to Matthew England, who sends $5 to say, can you explain how Hogan on Arsenio Hall led to the steroid trial? I don't think the doc was great at explaining that gap.
I mean, the Arsenio Hall show in and of itself did not lead to the steroid distribution trial. What led to, amazingly, to that, to the indictment was like, it started as an investigation into like the Ring Boy scandal. And then from there, like they did not end up pursuing charges as it related to trafficking or anything related to the Ring Boy scandal. It was the steroid trial. But what happened on the Arsenio Hall show is, and I can see that for a lot of these stories, is that there is some like filling in the gaps on certain details that there was just either not time to go as thorough into, but that's even at 6 hours, like when you're going through the pretty much history of WWE under Vince McMahon, you're going to have. But Hogan went on Arsenio Hall, and this was when, you know, he was under the gun, and he went on Arsenio Hall stating that there were only 3 times that he did steroids. And this so outraged people that knew this was such a lie that it put more attention on Hulk Hogan, not so much because he took steroids, but the fact he was so brazen about lying about it. And it did add to he did not do himself any favors. And Vince McMahon's side is that he had always told him to just go and tell the truth. That's his side to the whole thing. But that in and of itself, it was a bad move for Hulk Hogan, but not one that like that in and of itself led to the steroid trial several years later.
Gotcha. All right, let's go to forum.postwrestling.com.
Brian is in New Jersey. Incredible episode. I wish it was promoted more, considering what the crowd received. Daniel, listen, I can't argue. They did, I thought, a pretty great job of promoting this over the, like, you only had a few weeks to promote this. Like, you can't spend a month promoting a singular television show when you've got all these big shows back to back. But from 2 weeks ago, when they put the card together, like they hit this one really hard over these last 2 weeks. So I really cannot fault the hard promotion that they put into this. Like this from last week and then Collision on Saturday, they made this feel like a pay-per-view. I wouldn't knock the promotion of this. Danielson versus Nigel, Bucks versus Ospreay and Fletcher would have fit right in on a pay-per-view. Appropriate post-match angle and promo after the main event, which I also liked. Darby truly is a star, but him taking this match with Moxley proved to be a grade-A blunder for him. Rivaling all the times his surrogate dad Sting was fooled by the Horseman. I thought MVP was a cool surprise, and MVP just being out there by himself rather than with a bigger wrestler by his side was refreshing.
I think he does bring up like an interesting part about Darby, you know, who essentially gave up his chance to compete for a title on this show, even though the champion was wrestling anyway, and then ended up losing it. So he does kind of come out of this looking pretty dumb. I
and,
do
and
think
wasn't
they will
screwed
follow up,
either.
Though.
I mean, he lost. No. He was, you know, Jon Moxley should be the rightful number one contender. He beat the number one contender.
Yeah, but I do now, like, I mean, I did even before, but I see if Moxley ends up winning the championship, Darby being the perfect person to win it back from Mox.
That's my thought, is that, loss. You know, 2025 should be Darby's chase for this title. Mm-hmm. And maybe he goes into, to me, he would be, like, on the cusp, but he's next year's story as opposed to now, where the hotter, the more pressing match for Danielson is Moxley.
We got a Saeed from Vancouver. Audio issues aside from TSN, it was a stacked show that didn't slow down. Great matches up and down the card, from Nigel versus Brian to Hook versus Strong to Mariah versus Yuka. You have my vote to what my tag match of the year is, and that's the Bucks versus Ospreay and Fletcher. Main event delivered, but sucks for Darby to have to drop his title match at WrestleDream for this story. My prediction to Perry's mystery opponent is Lashley, and now MVP showing up tonight. Does that make it more believable, or do they hold him off for Swerve?
Well, Jack Perry's open challenge is for Collision Saturday, which was taped tonight. That I mean, I don't feel it's a spoiler to say it's not Bobby Lashley.
Right. Okay.
But I definitely think that people are expecting Lashley. I don't know if Jack Perry is the person you would be. Like, Lashley coming in, it would make the most sense for Swerve.
The mention of business, like, I think is deliberately meant to lead you to thinking that.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. 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 All right, your turn.
Sal from California. This was an excellent Dynamite, and the past 2 hours flew by. Felt like a mini pay-per-view with great matches and storyline developments. Highlights for me were the tag title match and Darby against Moxley. I also thought MVP had a great introduction. Question: would you prefer to see Mina Shirakawa turn heel on Willow and join Mariah, or keep Mina as a challenger for Mariah? I think Mariah has been lacking something since her title win, and forming a team with Mina could be interesting. I like the idea personally of Mariah having Mina, like, that being a unit for the time mm-hmm. being. I think it yeah. could help Mariah quite a bit, and I think it establishes Mina to have a more permanent role. I think she's an excellent heel, and I think those two could be really entertaining together, because I think there's a lot of challengers you can create for Mariah May. Mina does not have to be an immediate one.
I agree. I think Mariah May will be more threatening to have somebody attached to her, to have, like, a little faction or a unit, and I think Mina Shirakawa benefits greatly from, you know, having that attachment as well, rather than just cashing in on that singles match right away. And then where do you go from there? So I would like to see them maybe extend the relationship a little bit longer and then have a match. I think a lot of it also depends on how often we'll see Mina Shirakawa. I don't think I haven't heard anything about, like, her plans to, like, you know, move here permanently. That's also not to say she can't be a permanent fixture while, like, you know, sending in videos from time to time and, like, I don't know, maybe making a monthly trip or something, if that's in the cards. But I think the audience definitely wants to see more of Mina on a regular basis. Let's go to Curtis from the 519. An excellent episode of Dynamite in front of a great New York crowd. Two fantastic matches to bookend the show, and a five-star tag team match in the middle. That MVP promo was fantastic. When Swerve inevitably turns him down and Lashley debuts to destroy him, that is going to be a fantastic way to debut the new Hurt Business. The production on tonight's show stood out to me. AEW went above and beyond to show off the 8,500 plus people packed into the venue. I have been loving the unique production shots from them lately. Question: where do you see Jay White fitting into AEW when he returns? He feels like somebody that AEW has passed by with the emergence of Swerve, Ospreay, Hangman, etc. How can AEW reestablish him when he returns from injury?
I mean, it's going to be difficult. Like, that's what I say with, like, you have this incredible depth of talent, but inevitably there are going to be people you can focus on and people you can't focus on. Like, I think Jay White is a great performer, but you're in a sea of great performers, and to try and distance yourself and break out of the pack, it's very tough in this environment. And Jay White coming back, like, I would hope his ceiling is higher than just being in the trios division, but that's what I see him coming back to. And, you know, maybe he ends up in the Continental Classic and can have a showcase there. But, like, if I'm looking at who are my main event stars, like, I'm not going to totally discount that Jay White could break through to that, but he's got a lot of on top of him to break through to get to that level in AEW.
I think at this point, to me, he feels pretty firmly established as a mid-carder in this company. It also has kind of made me wonder if so much of his success has just come down to how much he was pushed by Gato versus in AEW, where, you know, Tony gets a new favorite almost like every single, I don't know, 3 months. And I don't see that freshness with Jay White, unless, you know, I think Jay White needs to find some form of evolution or reinvention in his own character. If anything, since he's been to AEW, I would say there's a bit of a regression, at least in terms of, like, how viable example he might be as a main eventer. I love the Bang Bang Gang. They clearly have like a great chemistry among the four of them, but they haven't really done anything all that intimidating, you know? Like, I you definitely get like their, you know, some form of like early DX vibe from the four of them together, but they've not done anything that notable, you know, to really kind of like make their mark in this company. So I hope to see some form of evolution from him. I haven't been terribly impressed by his promo work in AEW either. So I think at this stage you need to be better than I think what he's currently offering.
Jordan from the Bronx, that was a great Grand Slam. Nigel and Brian was a fantastic story of two storied rivals having one final showdown. Nothing was on the line except Nigel's pride in being able to prove to himself that he could hang with the world champion after all these years. Hook retiring the FTW belt is a good thing to start whittling down the titles, but it did feel like there may have been more going on. Was that a match to officially move Hook up the card, or could that potentially be him leaving AEW? I may be looking too much into it, but his speech felt more like a farewell than anything. MVP is here, teased a new version of the Hurt Business, and has immediately placed himself onto Swerve's radar. Exciting to see what's next. Darby is officially a geek for losing a title shot he never had to give up. I thought that this may have finally been the time to get Darby on a straight path to be world champion. His time will eventually come, I'm sure, but it felt like they were setting that in motion to happen sooner. And now that there's this complete change in direction with Moxley taking his spot.
I do think it's questionable, like, why Darby was given that win. What was it? A Battle Royal? A Casino Gauntlet or something? What did he win? Some sort of Battle Royal to earn the title shot in the first place.
It was the Rampage Rumble.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense just because they probably expected Darby to have a title match at you know, the Seattle show. Yeah, I get it. But didn't work out that way. Now, again, I think having Mox be the champion might be a direct path for Darby Allin to win the title off of a Moxley. But let's also remember the New Year is coming around and Everest climbing season is coming back soon. So how much can you really rely on a Darby Allin to hold your championship for? Darby has a lot of outside interests and projects going on. Maybe they're just kind of waiting for him to get all of that out of their system, out of his system before they commit. But we'll see. Let's go to Matthew, who says, this was a fun episode of Dynamite tonight with some excellent progressing of the stories and a good but cringy main event with Darby Allin spot. It definitely seems like the Don Callis family split is coming to climax with the finish of the tag match. What about Nigel? 48 years old, looking 35, incredible shape and incredible match. That Wrestle Dream match with Danielson versus Moxley is going to be super interesting. Part of me doesn't think Moxley will win, but let's not forget that Moxley came back and they changed the Grand Slam title match for this story, so I definitely think it's a real possibility.
Yeah, as we stated last week, I think that it's going to have that level of believability that Moxley could win. He's coming back. He's their top heel force going forward, and you could certainly justify the idea of doing the title switch and giving him that ammunition of ending Brian's full-time career.
And giving Brian that goodbye moment in front of a home crowd.
I think it's going to be the big selling feature of that pay-per-view is this match, now that you've got it and have several weeks to promote it.
I guess we ask, like, if not Seattle, then where could you see Brian having his last match of his full-time career? His last match, asterisk.
Full gear, Newark, New Jersey. Where else would you want to call it a day?
Right, of course. Lastly, let's go to Muggin, who says, Brian put Nigel in his place at a goddamn good
callbacks
match full of callbacks to their ROH feud. Osprey Fletcher Bucks was a barn burner with a weak finish. The absent-minded ref spots continue to plague these title matches. MVP showing up was a neat surprise, and sliding into a program with Swerve is smart. Does this mean Lashley isn't too far behind? That's what I think they want us to think. Moxley Allen did alter Wrestle Dream's main event, and let me tell you, Christian will not leave Tacoma world champion. Brian's final title run can't end by a 50-year-old.
Okay. Well, maybe it's going to end to however old John Moxley is.
40?
I think he's at 40.
39?
Let's
He's 38.
He's 38. All right. He'll be 39 in December. So anyway, under 40. All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for all of your great feedback. And we're back on Thursday. I will be back on Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern time for Pollock and Thurston. David Bix's band is going to join us. The focus of the show will be our thoughts on the Mr. McMahon documentary series and maybe filling in any of the gaps. And we will be taking feedback
super chats, whatever you would like to discuss. And then Wei and I, boy, buckle up, because Friday we will discuss episode one, which Wei has seen the complete episode of. That will be free for everybody on Friday. And then episodes 2 through 6 will be reviewed at postwrestlingcafe.com. Daily releases beginning Saturday on the cafe. The double shot. Get ready, Wei. You're going to need a couple double shots to get through the next week.
Oh, I've stocked up on my espresso, cold brew, hot brew, whatever you want to call it. Everything. Yes, I'll be ready.
Okay. Well, that's it for us. Thanks to everyone for tuning in. And that concludes Rewind to Dynamite. This month on the Post Wrestling Cafe, Wei Ting and I are reviewing the Mr. McMahon series on Netflix with 6 straight days of reviews. The double shot will be coming back on Friday, September the 27th. We will be doing a free review of episode 1, and then episodes 2 through 6 will be covered exclusively for Post Wrestling Cafe members. Plus, this month, MCU Later is back covering Agatha All Along, and Bruce Lord and Karen Peterson have you covered for New Japan's Destruction in Kobe. PostWrestlingCafe.com.
With Robinhood Gold, you don't need a silver spoon to eat up the financial favors of the 1%. Robinhood Gold allows a resourceful individual to earn the very liberal rate of 4.5% APY on uninvested cash, receive unlimited 1% deposit bonuses, and be rewarded with a handsome 3% retirement boost on an IRA account. Get the privileges of the high net worth for any net worth for just $5 a month. Sign up at Robinhood.com/gold. Terms apply. For product-specific disclosures, visit Robinhood.com/gold. Investing involves risk. Rate may change. Gold membership is offered by Robinhood Gold LLC.